Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
But first, tonight President Bush will address the nation from New Orleans with his administration's plans to address the devastation from Hurricane Katrina. The president takes the stage at a time when polls show many Americans are losing confidence in his ability to lead, both in the fight against terrorism and in the effort to rebuild after Katrina. Martha Joint Kumar is a political science professor at Towson University in Maryland. She joins us from her office in Washington. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
And tell us, what are the stakes for President Bush tonight? How important is this?
They're very high because it goes to the whole question of the quality of his leadership. That's what's come under fire in these last 2 weeks.
Well, one of his strengths has always been the public's faith in his ability to lead. Do you see that changing?
I certainly do in the polls. During the campaign, you know, he had one speech that he used everywhere he went, and this is a line that always drew great applause. Sometimes I'm a little too blunt. I get that from my mother. Sometimes I mangle the English language. I get that from my dad. But all the time, whether you agree with me or not, you know where I stand and where I'm going to lead this nation. And that's what has come into question. That, in fact, the public was ahead of the president in terms of knowing what the devastation was with Hurricane Katrina.
And it has also affected the public's feelings about the war, this sense of leadership question. A new Wall Street Journal NBC poll, we read 55% favor bringing soldiers home from Iraq, 36% say the current levels should be maintained, as the president says. And we're noting that those people, ironically, may be Democrats like Hillary Clinton. So what does this say about President Bush's base?
I think that all of these different things are coming together. You also have the gasoline price raise, and that has been a big issue as well. And he has lost confidence in to a greater extent among Republicans than he has with Democrats and Independents, because they didn't have the same confidence to start with. So his the stakes here are very large, because people have to have a sense that he knows what the problems are first, and then second, that he has solutions that will actually deal with those problems.
And this is what he has to telegraph tonight. He's expected to talk about the $200 billion proposed package, the biggest reconstruction package in U.S. history, cost of more than Iraq, to rebuild the Gulf. But this recent poll from NBC and Wall Street Journal also says that 60% of Americans believe that rebuilding the coast is more important than establishing democracy in Iraq, and they want to take money from Iraq to rebuild after Katrina.
Yes. I think people can understand a domestic crisis. They see it right in front of them, and they can put themselves in that position. And when they look at Iraq, what they see on television is they see all of the suicide bombings. They see the lists of names of people who have died, of American troops. And then on their local televisions, they see the funerals of those same people. So, you know, I think that that Americans don't like to see things go on and on and on, and they feel that a great deal of time and resources, particularly human resources, as well as funds, have been spent in Iraq, and they just don't see that we're getting out of it what they expected.
There are, by the way, some bright spots in the polls. Americans largely like his Supreme Court nominee, John Roberts, but Martha Kumar, it would seem as if the president has his job cut out for him tonight.
Oh, he certainly does, because he does have all of these things coming together that are not good news for him. And tonight what he'll probably do is talk about specific programs, the housing, what they're going to be doing with housing, jobs, health care. He's missed the opportunity where at the beginning he could have talked to the American people about what the nature of the problem was and how we had to come together.
But perhaps he can make
nation.
Up for it tonight. Martha Joint Kumar, professor of political science at Towson University in Maryland, will be watching along with you. Thank you.
Good. Thank you.
Well, it is a diaspora of historic proportions. Hurricane Katrina has forced around 1 million people from their homes along the Gulf Coast in what may be the largest dislocation in the U.S. in more than 100 years, may be bigger but certainly quicker than the Dust Bowl migration or the Great Migration that started after World War I. It's culture shock for many, black Southerners, for instance, finding themselves in largely white Utah, or here in Massachusetts on Cape Cod, where winter is bearing down, and cities like Baton Rouge are suddenly doubling in size and having to share their resources. On the other hand, many of the evacuees riding airplanes for the first time are finding they like what they see in the rest of the country. They may stay. Well, what might this new forced migration mean for the people involved and the nation as a whole? We turn now to Stephen Hahn, history professor at the University of Pennsylvania, also the author of the book A Nation Under Our Feet, Black Political Struggles in the Rural South, From Slavery to the Great Migration. Professor, welcome.
Hi, Robin. Nice to be here.
Well, you know, others are saying that this is, if not the greatest displacement of Americans in 150 years, it's certainly close. Can you just give us your overarching thought, first of all? How does it rank, if you will?
Well, as you can imagine, this is an incredibly overwhelming and sobering historical and political episode. In order to think about its historical place, one would have to think, of course, about the Great Migration, which, at least in the 19-teens and 1920s, brought over 1 million African Americans out of the urban and rural South into the urban North.
Let's remind ourselves, as you said, that was at the turn of the century, the Great Migration.
Yes.
And it was to look for jobs?
Well, it was, there were push and pull factors. Until the turn of the 20th century, it was very difficult for African Americans to migrate out of the South because Northern employers were not hiring them. They were not hiring them both because of racism and because of the volume of European immigration that was taking place during the 19th century. So with World War I in particular and the manpower needs that military mobilization demanded, there was new there was a labor shortage, mm-hmm. and therefore labor recruiters were going through the South, and African Americans in the South were beginning to discuss the issue among themselves, and a process began that by 1930 it brought about 1.5 million African Americans into the North.
Well, you just said something important, 1.5 million, which is a huge number, but over a period of a little over a decade.
Right. Okay. Well, you know, the other thing we have to think about, too, in terms of this relocation is that it's not a voluntary one where the Great Migration was. Here we're dealing with a situation where there is, in many ways, forced evacuations and people are ending up in locales that until they get on the plane or on the bus, they don't even know where they're going. So you think about what is this to be likened to? And I think the things that come to mind, really, you know, African Americans have been on the move for centuries, often in coercive fashion. You think about the international slave trade. You think about the interstate slave trade, where in the early 19th century, over a period of a couple of decades, again, over 1 million African Americans were coercively moved from what we call the Upper South to the Deep South as the cotton plantation system was developing. And one also thinks about the Civil War period, when after the Union Army invaded the South and African Americans fled from their plantations and farms to Union lines and an imagined freedom, suddenly there were thousands and thousands of African Americans who were in many ways herded into what were known as contraband camps. And then, of course, once the war ended, African Americans were wandering all over the South looking for family members who had been separated from each other owing to sale and other aspects of enslavement. So I think we need to look at what's happening now, not only in relationship to voluntary migrations, but also to the many involuntary migrations that took place, too.
Right. And what you just said was eerily reminiscent of now, people looking for family members. There have been, though, other groups of peoples who have migrated voluntarily and involuntarily. You know, of course, thinking the Mormons, who made their trek to Salt Lake. And,
right.
And then the huge one that comes to mind is the Dust Bowl.
Right, exactly. But even in that circumstance, and that certainly dislocated thousands and thousands of people under very difficult circumstances, in a sense, it might be likened to this because there are elements of natural disaster involved, too.
Remind us, it was a drought.
Yes, exactly. But people were picking up, and they were moving as families, and they were moving as communities, and they made certain decisions about where they wanted to go. Now, the circumstances under which they did it and the kind of conditions they had to endure once they got, say, to places like California, were very, very bad. But here again, we're dealing with a situation where people are effectively left to their own devices, and then all of a sudden they are being picked up and relocated to places that are, you know, for decisions that are being made by public officials that have very no consultation with the evacuees.
And they're doing it in what would seem like an abrupt manner. I mean, someone said it's as if the Dust Bowl happened in 14 days.
That's right, exactly.
What's the possible result of that?
Again, you know, let's say you would take a case like the interstate slave trade, which is in some ways a good example because you're talking about a process by which people are being coercively removed from one place, taken out of networks of kinship and other sort of community relations, and being taken to another area where they have to reconstitute those relations. You know, as you can imagine, this is an incredibly wrenching process in many, many ways, and the consequences are that people are unavoidably left to their own devices, and oftentimes people who have a hard time fending for themselves. The other side of the picture is that even under the most awful circumstances, that these relationships are in fact rebuilt, communities are in fact rebuilt, and the history of African Americans in the United States is one of constant movement, coercion, separation, destruction, and rebuilding. It's really an extraordinary story that I think many Americans are really unaware of, and in some ways one can hope that this particular episode will be part of a learning experience so that our society will have a better understanding of what, in fact, this experience has been like.
We're talking about the new migration, people forced from their homes by Hurricane Katrina, with Stephen Hahn. He's professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. We're going to have more with Professor Hahn, including all the good that can come from mass movement of people. But first, what are your thoughts about the new diaspora? Are you in it? Are you receiving it? Well, send us an email with your thoughts. We would love to hear from you at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can always call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to tell us how to pronounce your full name and also tell us the town you're from. Well, as we said, more with Professor Hahn in a moment. And later in the program, what happened at the Convention Center in New Orleans, a timetable of 5 days of complete horror. Much more ahead, here and now. Hahn about the new diaspora caused by Hurricane Katrina. And Professor Hahn, we've seen people coming from countries outside of the U.S. having this experience. 125,000 Cubans resettled in Miami. 1.4 million Southeast Asians came to the U.S. in the 70s, following Vietnam, all seeking refuge. This migration is, of course, different. The evacuees from Katrina are from here, and they were forced to leave their homes and move to communities where they have few social connections. They may not want to stay there, and the communities where they land may not want them to stay long term.
That's right. They are being taken to places where they do not have connections. They don't know people there. Oftentimes, there are not black communities of any size where they're going. And the communities themselves, it's not entirely clear what sort of backlashes may take place sooner rather than later. We do know that, for example, when a great migration was taking place, one of the things that was happening was that as the black population grew in cities in the north, Chicago and Detroit and Cleveland and New York, there was also a great increase of racial tension, an explosion of riots. Whether this will be the case here is unclear, but it certainly means that public officials and the society at large has to be very mindful of how difficult this situation is going to be. And then, of course, some people are going to want to stay and some people are going to want to go back.
By the way, but to your other point, Baton Rouge, for instance, is a city that's already doubled in size.
That's right.
Because of many people who say they want to stay there.
That's right. And it's not entirely clear that everyone in Baton Rouge is so thrilled about this. And so there are going to be unavoidable social and political tensions as a result. And, of course, you don't want to see a situation where the victim is once again blamed for this. So there's an enormous series of problems that are going to have to be faced. And one can only feel very fearful about this because they were faced so poorly in the preparation.
Professor Hahn, we've been speaking about some of the negatives that come from mass migrations. You talked about job tensions during the great migration of the turn of the century when poor blacks coming from the South looking for jobs had to fight for those jobs with, I'm imagining, I think it was an immigrant population.
And for housing and for public space, right.
Right. But what are some of the positives that come when a people's move?
Well, if you think, for example, about the Great Migration, it reconfigured the political landscape of the United States. Now, remember, at that particular time, segregation and disfranchisement were well-established institutions in the South. African Americans did not have the right to vote, and they were excluded from many areas of public life or segregated within it. And although de facto segregation was also the case in the North, they could move to the North and they could vote and they could mobilize politically in ways that were very difficult to do in the South. And the Great Migration needs to be understood in connection, for example, with the building of the New Deal coalition of the 1930s, the civil rights movement in the country as a whole in this period, the organization of industrial labor and the CIO, and I think played an important role in a democratic, small d, democratic impulse that comes through America in the 1930s and 1940s. That certainly, and I think it had a lot to do with great changes that would take place after World War II. So, you know, it's not inconceivable that the aftermath of this awful event will have certain positive consequences. It just depends on whether we're willing to face up to what we've seen and whether we're willing to listen to the voices of those who had endured this and to think about what they are saying in meaningful ways. I think under those circumstances, there are always, you know, possibilities that and good ones that might come of this.
Well, what do you think the political ramifications will be of so many largely African Americans, largely Democrats, fanning out across the country and leaving the Louisiana area?
It's very clear one of the problems all along was that no one was representing them. No one was speaking for them. No one was bringing their own concerns and own experiences to any preparation process. I mean, these are not people with money. These are not people with power. And these are not people with an effective voice in our political system, and I think we need to recognize that and recognize that the consequence for all of us is that we have large numbers of Americans who are effectively cut out of an opportunity to be part of any sort of democratic process.
Stephen Hahn is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania and author of the book A Nation Under Our Feet, Black Political Struggles in the Rural South from Slavery to the Great Migration, as he mentioned, the Great Migration of the Turn of the Century. And, Professor, it seems as if it could have also been titled A Nation on Its Feet.
Yes. You know, if you think about it historically, people of African descent, ever since the 15th century, have been among the most mobile people on the face of the earth. And again, what one can see in this history is a combination of, enormous exploitation and dislocation that has to be endured, and yet at the same time, an incredible ability to deal with it, to adapt, to transform themselves socially and culturally, and in effect, to change the world in which we live. The process of moving from slavery to the Great Migration was one that not only transformed African Americans, but also transformed the country as a whole. And I think they made a great difference, hopefully. And that's because, their voices were there, and they certainly made a very important difference on the ground in the South. I hope that in this case, they'll be able to make a difference in how we think about our cities and how we think about our society.
Professor Stephen Hahn of the University of Pennsylvania, thanks very much. Well, stay with us when we come back. What happened at the New Orleans Convention Center? Much more coming up here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR in Boston.
One knew who was in charge. Those are the words of 9/11 Commission Chair Thomas Kane, speaking yesterday of the response to Hurricane Katrina. Kane also noted that the death toll from the hurricane would have been lower had his commission's emergency preparedness recommendations been implemented. Well, the lead article in today's Washington Post describes exactly what happened in what arguably can be called the disaster's ground zero, the New Orleans Convention Center. After more than 70 interviews, the reporters have pieced together a horrific timeline of events, and joining us on the line is co-author of the article, Washington Post reporter Ann Scott Tyson. Ann, welcome.
Thank you.
And would you start by taking us back? The Superdome was designated as a shelter in New Orleans. The convention center, which you're speaking of, and it's 10 blocks away, was not. It was only supposed to be a bus stop for people to be picked up at. But when the levee broke and the water started rising around the Superdome, it became full. So were then people directed to the convention center?
I think it was a combination of people spontaneously moving towards high ground and the fact that they simply couldn't be dropped off at the Superdome because the waters were rising there and the Superdome was also becoming very crowded. Mm.
So there was no water stockpiled there, no food, it was not a real shelter.
Exactly.
Well, as you write, soon as many as 20,000 people are now showing up at the convention center, but the manager has locked the doors because he has nothing for them. How did they get in?
Well, the doors were all locked. He had security guards, but they were all unarmed. And he believes that just by yanking and pulling the door back and forth, that they eventually got one open. And because all of the doors were what they call, had panic hardware on them, which meant they could all be open from inside. Once one door was open, all the doors could be open from the inside.
And to add to this, Louisiana officials that you spoke with say that they had long warned that rival housing project gangs should be in different shelters in the event of an emergency. But, this was chaos. They were all together there. No one was screening for guns as they did at the Superdome. So what was the result?
Well, basically, very quickly, sort of a rampage began where these groups of youth were just breaking into everything they could in the building, including some very large stores of liquor, drinking, taking out as many as 50 cases of hard liquor and hundreds of cases of beer, running around hot wiring, forklifts, little electric utility carts, and gunfire became more and more rampant and widespread in the building.
Well, you are writing about a five-day horror that began on Monday. By Tuesday, the Louisiana National Guard unit had been deployed inside the convention center, but they were in another part of the center separated by a wall?
That's correct. They had selected the center, I guess, as a staging base. This is a collection of troops from a few different engineering units, and they had a lot of high water trucks, a lot of Humvees, and other equipment that they were going to use to start doing their normal rescue mission, which is debris removal and some security type missions.
They were engineers largely. They weren't they weren't schooled in crowd control.
That's true. Nevertheless, I mean, all basic troops have basic soldiering skills, you know, such as how to set up checkpoints and how to perform basic security missions.
Right. Well, so at this point, the guard is on one side of the wall. The people are pounding on the other side of the wall because of the hell they're going through. At one point, the convention center staff that we mentioned snuck away. They fled. Buses came by but didn't pick anybody up. Briefly, because we have heard the stories, but not in the way you've described them. How bad did it get?
Well, it got to the point where basically everybody who could was trying to flee the building in any way they could, and including the Louisiana National Guard.
Armed National Guardsmen didn't feel safe, to the extent, you write, that they actually put some of their trucks up against the wall to keep the people out.
Yeah, exactly. Even on as early as Tuesday, I think they could sense a security threat for themselves. So some of their higher-ups called back more weapons and ammunition and had a supply sergeant bring that, you know, forward to them. So they blocked, they moved at least three of their vehicles against the doors, sort of went to get their weapons at the ready and for whatever they might face from the crowd.
There are other events that you describe. At one point, a New Orleans police SWAT team comes in but just rescues two white women that are related to another police officer and back out with her, which enraged the crowd, which was largely black. The Louisiana National Guard did leave. 24 hours later, the Arkansas National Guard troops did come in. They were fresh from Iraq. They were armed with rifles and full body armor. And it seems as if order was immediately restored as soon as somebody took charge.
Yeah, the Arkansas Guardsmen who I was with did not face any significant trouble or resistance. They were all really surprised at how smoothly it went. They rolled in looking very imposing.
How many of them were there, by the way?
There were at least 300 of them, and there may have been some other guard units as well.
But that was about as many as there were Louisiana Guard members.
Yeah, that's true. You know, it's perplexing. It's certainly certainly something that could have been considered, and it's interesting that the Guard commander from the Louisiana Guard, he felt confident that if so ordered, they could have calmed down the situation, but he was never ordered to do it. He said it never came up. They were just preparing for their next mission.
5 days, no food, no water, no light at night, 20,000 people in a building. When all is said and done, in your last paragraph, you speak to a medic who went in after the building was cleared. Can you just tell us briefly what he found?
Yeah, he went into an entrance that was actually very close to the area where the guard was staying, and he found four bodies there. One elderly woman slumped over in a wheelchair, another man sort of curled up on the floor next to her, a very large man who sort of had his arms up in the air, and then there was another woman not far from him, and they all were laying in pools of dried blood, and his assessment was that they had been killed, that they had been beaten to death.
And Anne, you write that as many as 10 people may have died in the convention center, including a little boy who died early on. He had difficulty breathing, and no one could help him, and no one removed his body.
Yeah, that's true. That was an account from the people, eyewitnesses who were present in the convention center.
Ann Scott Tyson, staff writer with the Washington Post. She co-wrote today's lead story about what happened in five hellish days inside the New Orleans Convention Center after Hurricane Katrina. Ann, thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
Well, more than $60 billion have been pledged by the federal government to aid in Hurricane Katrina relief. But where's it going to come from? Well, one citizen of Bozeman, Montana, is suggesting that her state give up pork. Now, there are about $25 billion worth of pork projects in the $286 billion federal highway project, a new hiking trail for Indiana, a bike path for New Jersey, and a parking garage for Bozeman. Well, Tracy Velasquez is that person. She's also an activist, and she's run for office in Bozeman. But Tracy was on the line. We understand you made this appeal to your city officials as just a regular citizen.
I sure did. I was thinking about how we were going to pay for Hurricane Katrina, and it was sort of one of those aha moments, and I thought, well, you know, when you look at the scale of the needs right now in the country, the financial needs, it seems like the needs for the hurricane are pretty substantial, and a parking garage is maybe something we in Bozeman could pay for ourselves or put off for a while. And so I sent a letter to the commission and went before them that Monday and made the proposal.
Well, now tell us more about this garage. It was this was the $4 million garage that's set for the downtown area.
I assume it's going to be more than $4 million, but I do know that there was a $4 million earmarked appropriation in the highway bill for it.
Mm-hmm. And where would it be? Who's going to use it?
Well, downtown Bozeman is a fairly growing area. We are sort of part of the New West that's growing pretty fast in America. And, you know, the city commissioners felt that for us to grow more, we maybe needed some more parking. So, you know, certainly parking is something that's important in downtown areas, but the question of whether federal highway money should be spent for it in a time when we have a lot of significant national financial needs is something that I think a lot of communities, whether it's a parking garage or a bridge or whatever it is, we need to take a hard look at it.
Well, as you know, not everyone's happy with this idea. In Alaska, they've got $454 million earmarked for a couple of bridges, thanks to Don Young, who's the House Transportation Committee chair, who got that money for his home state. And a spokesperson in his office told the Anchorage Daily News that the pork for relief swap was moronic. Your thoughts?
I'm not too concerned about folks in Alaska criticizing what we're doing in Bozeman, Montana. I think that the folks in rural communities around Montana probably understand a little bit better about budgeting than folks in Washington these days. I think it's hard for senators and congressmen these days because they feel like if they don't bring home these big projects, people aren't going to vote for them. But, you know, I think it's time that folks back home say, you know, we understand that it's sort of a belt tightening time. We need to try and prioritize what has to get done. And if folks in Washington can't do it, they feel like someone's not going to vote for them again or whatever, you know, we can do it here at the local level. We can come up with ways to try to save money for the expensive things that have to happen with important projects like Hurricane Katrina.
Well, you've written a letter to the editor in Bozeman, and I note that you've got a cookbook on your bookshelf that's sort of inspired you.
I do.
What's that?
Yeah, it's a victory cookbook, 1943, and what the whole purpose of the cookbook was to get Americans to use less of the foods that the troops needed back in overseas. So this idea of sort of a shared sacrifice of pulling together and directing resources where they're really needed is very American.
Do you think though that this time around Americans will give up their pork?
I think that Americans really are starting to get it. You know, we've got a huge federal deficit and a huge federal debt, and you know, as I have a small business, and you know, I have a family, and we understand that, you know, if Dad loses his job, you probably can't go to Disneyland this year. And I think this is a situation where Americans know we can't leave this kind of bill for our kids and our grandkids.
Tracy Velasquez, who's asked her city officials in Bozeman, Montana, to give up $4 million that was allotted for a parking garage in Bozeman. She says it should go to Katrina Hurricane Relief, and they are considering that. Tracy, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks, and I wanted to let folks know, you know, if you're interested, I did set up a little website, because that's America. I've called it leaderswillfollow.org. And if folks want to get together and think about how they might be able to make this work in their community, I'm happy to do what I can.
Thank you, Tracy.
Thank you.
And you can go to our website for more, here-now.org. More ahead, here and now. relics of an ancient civilization, windows onto a world that we know very little about. They are quipus, joined strings of knots, probably part of a record-keeping system of the Incan Empire of South America, which thrived in the late 15th and early 16th century. But how to decipher them? That's been a mystery that has tied up anthropologists for years. One of those researchers is Gary Erden. He's a professor of pre-Columbian studies at Harvard University. He and his fellow researcher, Carrie Brazine, recently announced some fascinating new findings regarding these artifacts, and they both join us in the studio. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
And we should say we have pictures of quipus on our website if people want to go there, here-now.org. But first of all, Gary, can you describe them further, these pieces of rope that have knots in them?
Quipus look probably as much as anything like a mop, a mop that has knots tied into the strings. They're made either of spun and plied threads of camelid fiber, of llama or alpaca, or of cotton fibers. And in some cases, the makers of the quipus also applied vegetal dyes to them, so they can be quite colorful and quite beautiful.
Have they long thought to be some sort of accounting system?
Yes, we actually have some accounts from the Spanish chroniclers who tell us explicitly that in Inca times that the Inca record keepers, the Inca quipu keepers, used these devices to record numerical statistical data. Mm-hmm. The thing that we've recently found and that, in fact, has gained some attention from various news agencies is that we think that we've identified a group of quipus, a set of seven quipus, that, as we understand it, were communicating with each other about, we think, probably tax data. Mm-hmm. And on those quipus, we argue in the paper that it may be that we have a configuration of knots, a certain configuration of knots, that may be the place name where these quipus were found, which was the Palace of Puruchuco, which is on the central coast of Peru near Lima.
Which leads us to this new fascinating thinking. Now, the Incans, although one of the largest empires, was also thought to be one of the largest groups of people to not have any written language. So, Carrie Brazine, again, Gary's a fellow researcher, will this finding change that?
Well, we are certain that the Incas used quipu to communicate over distance, so that it functioned, quipu could function like a writing system in the sense that someone in one place could record something and send it to someone at another place, and that second person could decipher it.
And not just numbers or accounting of stock, livestock, or something like that.
Well, that's sort of the big question. For a long time, as Gary often says, we've known that there's numbers on these quipu, but we've never known, you know, 42 of what, whether it's 42 mm-hmm. bushels of potatoes or 42 llama or 42 people. So we don't yet know exactly what the numbers refer to, although we assume from the colonial documents there's evidence that there were censuses and there were there was accounting of various resources and so forth. But there are also quipu that don't fit neatly into the numerical paradigm, and those we think could be more narrative in style, so could have recorded myths or history, something besides just numbers.
How would something look like a word to you in these knots?
Well, I'm not sure that it would ever really look like a word the way we think of a word as a sign that's scratched or painted or drawn on a two-dimensional surface. We think that what they were doing was they were through various physical features of the construction of the quipus, and that included color as mm-hmm. well, mm-hmm. that they were creating different configurations in these colored strings that they would then assign conventional value to. So just as, for instance, we can have a set of three squiggles that we can all agree represent A-N-D, and mm-hmm. so it stands for the word and, mm-hmm. they could create these configurations of knotted strings, spinning the string this way, tying the knot that way, giving the whole configuration a certain color. And they could then, as a group of people, they could decide on a value to assign for that. So they could say, this is the configuration to which we want to assign the name of this king or mm-hmm. that province or that place. So what we call a word might not look anything like what we're familiar with when we see a word.
Right. Carrie, I know you just returned from Peru. Do people know about quipus? You're laughing. Is it something that still resonates for Peruvians today? Or?
Well, it definitely resonates on a couple different levels. Peruvians are aware of their heritage, and so they tend to be very interested in ancient quipu as an object that represents some of their great history. But there are quipu that still exist. They're different.
Really? How old would they be?
That's a very good question. We don't know exactly. I just returned from a village where I was working on a patrimonial quipu, and our guess at this point is that it may be 200 years old.
And what do you mean by patrimonial?
When we say patrimonial, we're referring to quipu that exist in the context of a community, of a contemporary community, and that are typically used in yearly rituals, especially rituals when community leadership changes hands. Mm. So the quipus tend to be used as we might use a badge of office.
Yeah. That, if I could just take a second, what is that like to walk into this village and see this thing from hundreds of years ago with some riddle in it?
It's daunting, but it's also very exciting. My hope is that the research can be done in a way such that the villagers will benefit from it. And even as I was there this summer, I think we did see the result of that because the quipu is gradually gaining some publicity and more people are coming to the village, which is a very good thing.
Just to see it.
Just to see, what it's like.
And Gary, why is it important to, you know, as you said, it looks like a mop. Why is it so important to know about it?
Well, I think the study of the quipu is really very important in a number of respects. One has to do with this question of whether or not the Incas, who were the lords of what was in fact the largest empire in the New World, whether or not they actually devised a system for record keeping that was comparable to the kinds of systems that were invented and used by all the other ancient civilizations. They may never have invented a system of writing, but they may in fact have invented something truly unique in world civilization, which was a system of recording information in three-dimensional strings. And the other issue has to do with the fact that all of what we know about ancient Peru, the ancient Inca civilization, comes to us from the words and the thoughts and the ideas of Spanish conquerors and Spanish priests who encountered the Incas and wrote about them using their own words and their own ideas and their own views of them, or of the archaeological record, which of course is mute. If we're ever able to decipher, which is a very bold word for us to use, but we think it may be possible one day, if we're ever able to decipher the Inca quipus, we may actually be able to experience the world as it was experienced and as it was named and understood by the Inca people themselves.
Gary Urton is the professor of pre-Columbian studies at the Department of Anthropology at Harvard University. Carrie Brazine is the quipu database manager at Harvard. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And again, to see the images of the quipus, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories.